about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward.
To infinity and beyond!
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking, don't they?
It's classified.
You talking to me?
I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
I can't lie!
Expecto Patronum!
Entertainment X.
You never know what you're gonna get.
For this conversation, I chat with M. Saibu on the phone. He is a film writer, director, and producer located in LA. So we get deep, deep, deep into the conversation of pitching a TV show, film, a script, something you've already filmed. So there's a long section in this conversation where we really dive deep into the logistics of film production. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did, and keep on keeping on. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we are back, and today with me is M. Saibu on the phone. Thank you so much for taking this time to chat with me.
Very, very happy to be on the show, man. I'm really excited.
Thanks, dude. Thank you. I want to start with joining the military. You served in the military. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious about your travels that brought you around the world and how you ended up kind of serving in the military.
Oh, yeah. That actually has a tie to my family. My stepdad is, he's in the army. He still is, actually. And at the time that I left Ghana to join them, they were in Germany at this point, and he actually still is stationed in Germany, believe it or not.
Oh,
it's
wow.
A long time now. Yeah. Wow. And so, yeah, so we kind of, I was kind of raised in that system, you know, the army system, and on post, to just kind of getting used to the mindset and the way things worked in the military way. So when it came to me moving out and coming to the States, I just felt, you know, it was a natural place for me to go. Plus, it also felt like it was something that I had to do inwardly, because I just felt like I needed to give back to a country that had given so much to me. So I joined the Air Force, actually.
Wow. Where did you serve in one particular spot, or were you traveling all over?
Well, I traveled, but I had one main base. When I joined, I first went through basic training at Lackland Air Force Base, and then it was just in Texas. And after that place, I was taken to Virginia, Fort Lee, an army post, to do my something we called tech school, where you kind of go learn what job you're supposed to do and when you actually join the force and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
And then from there, yeah, you know, and then I went to Beale Air Force Base, California, which actually became my main base. So this is where I did most of my service. I was at Beale Air Force Base, and then I would be, you know, sent out every now and then for like a TDY once, I think. And I deployed once too.
Wow. Wow. So what led to you leaving Ghana, or what age did that happen at?
That actually was supposed to happen really early in the 2000s, but my dad felt like it would be a good idea for us to be in Ghana, and kind of, he wanted me to do like high school and all that kind of stuff in there. But his plan actually kind of fell through, because he passed away in 2004. And so there was actually no prospect of me leaving the country anymore, you know. And he always knew that I wanted to be a writer and stuff like that, and he always felt like I'll be better off outside the country trying to pursue these kinds of things, because that's not something that you're going to get very successful in Ghana.
Okay.
You know, so when that was gone, it was just kind of like, you know, that was gone. But then my mom got married to my stepdad, and they moved to Germany. And when I got out of high school in 2008, they were like, hey, man, we want you to come over here and join us. And the original plan was actually for me to go to college over there and stuff like that. But, you know, other things happened, and I decided to do the military instead.
Wow. Now, does anything stand out in your mind from your travels around the world in terms of understanding other cultures and what you've learned kind of from seeing all different parts?
Yeah, actually, I was actually talking about that with someone recently. It's, for me, what it is giving me is perspective and the ability to empathize with several different kinds of points of view, you know, several different points of view, because when you've actually lived through a culture, and I always like to say that when you learn a language, it comes with the culture, you know, so the more languages you learn, the more cultures you're able to appreciate. So basically, when you're able to do that, you get to understand things from a very, very different perspective. Like when you sometimes understand the way someone's language structure is set up, now you might understand how they say certain things in English, and you might not get offended anymore because you just understand culturally this is where that is coming from.
I see.
You know, there's a lot of different things that I'm learning, that I learned, you know, throughout that, you know, and for me, that's really what it is to be able to get along with almost anyone. I could be sitting with someone who hates everything I do, and I'll still be able to find a common ground where the two of us can meet.
Wow. Yeah, that's just so, I mean, I can only imagine how much that builds character as you literally travel across the world, especially in terms of like language, like what you just said. You're bringing up a really great point, because the way a phrase is said in English is different from the way it's said in German or Spanish,
right,
or what have you.
Right.
And it carries a whole different meaning when you actually understand that communication there. Wow. So what did your parents teach you about work ethic?
My father, especially, my mom too, but I'll get to that. That one is a little different. But my father, for like just work, he always wanted to be a writer, right?
Okay.
I found out this very like late in his life. Like when he found out I was writing, he let me know that. And what he told me about work ethic was, despite that, when he wasn't able to do that, he still didn't let the fact that he was doing something he didn't completely love deter him from making sure that he always did his best at it. So basically, what he always felt was, regardless of what it is, so long as you're responsible for it, you have to do your best at it. If you are responsible for it, if your name is on it, you have to do everything you can to make sure that it comes out the way it should, and or exceed the way it should.
Yeah.
My mom, she taught me basically perseverance. You know, there was a very hard time after she and my dad had broken up. He had left the country for a while, and there were a lot of hard times and stuff like that. And she would still be very diligent in every little job she would start and take and stuff, you know. And sometimes I would feel like she was doing, you know, too much for so little. But what that taught me was, again, like, regardless of what it is, if you're responsible for it, you have to make sure that you do it right. So I guess both of them kind of had, in different ways, taught me the same lesson about always making sure that you execute things. It's the same thing, kind of the same thing that Air Force preaches, actually, excellence in all you do, you know.
Yeah. How about kindness?
Who?
Kindness. What did your parents teach you about kindness?
Kindness. Oh, yeah. You know, that is actually one of the biggest things we learned, because, when my dad left, we kind of went through a very dark spell where, like, you know, and we're living up north, and if you know Ghana, up north is basically in the country, you know, really deep, kind of in the kind of environment you might see on CNN, kind of, not that much, but kind of, you know, close enough. And, you know, living in a mud hut, all that.
Okay.
But, you know, while we're over there, one thing I noticed was there was never a time where anyone would go hungry. And there's a reason why. Like, it's coming back to that kindness thing. Regardless of what, it was something we called a compound house, right? And it was different families in there. But what would happen was, regardless of what was going on, whoever would cook just basically would cook for everybody. So even if this family is going through a hard time, for that time, they wouldn't feel it. They wouldn't, you would not even know, because food-wise, they'll be good.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, living where they live and stuff like that. And another thing was my granddad's house also was, despite the fact that he wasn't like a rich man or anything, it was always open to anyone. You know, and that always used to be weird to me when I was a kid. You know, I didn't understand it. But then now as an adult, when I went back to Ghana, there were a lot of these kids that helped me out in different parts of the country, like where I would do, you know, I'll run into someone and I'm trying to look up something. I run into one of these kids from back in the day. And I'll go, hey, what are you looking for? And before I know it, I'm, you know, and that is that kindness thing. That is the return of that kindness that my, you know, my family paid them several years ago, you know, and basically is to pay it forward with everything you do and not expect anything back, because regardless, kind of the way that the world works, doing something kind has never been a bad thing.
Yeah.
And it's always improved everything. There's never been a time where someone was kind to somebody and it somehow deterred their character for being kind. It always made them the bigger person. It always made you, it's always a good thing to do, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you're right. Being kind has never hurt anyone.
Yeah.
That's such a great point. It is. I'm curious on discipline in terms of family and then military, how that maybe specifically translated into your writing and film creation.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, before the military, I actually used to think I was disciplined in the way that I would write, you know, because I would have like three different things going on at the same time. And the fact that I felt I could kind of keep the same thought stream for all three, I felt I was being very disciplined with that kind of work ethic. But after joining the military, I became more of a, you know, you learn the thing of keeping to what is in front of you.
Yeah.
And doing the mission that is right, like that is essential right now. Do that right now. That kind of sense of urgency, you know, it instilled that in me, like that I need to get things done. So when I start on something, I don't want to jump on another thing anymore. You know, I need to I focus on it. And then I've realized that actually helps, because it's able to let me focus everything on it, and I'm able to get through it and actually in a more efficient manner than I used to, when I used to like have about three different projects in the works. Because
Wow. And
you never get to finish any of those. Like, you just keep kind of going between projects all the time.
Wow. So how did you get into film?
Well, I've kind of always been into it. And it started with the writing, I always say. It started with me just writing, you know, short stories, all these kinds of, and I wrote a few like manuscripts for books. And then it just kind of evolved into a place where I felt like I need to see these things that I'm coming up with, like these stories that I'm kind of, you know, bringing together and stuff. I just wanted to see them now. I wanted to bring it to life and make it real. You know, and the natural progression basically led to filmmaking. And before I joined the military, I wanted to do that, but there was no way for me to be able to get funding, buy equipment, learn, you know, actually, you know, be able to take some classes and stuff like that. So I was like, well, while I'm in the military, that'll be what I'm going to do on this, you know, as my school thing on the side. And then while I was in the military, I kind of actually was lucky. They had me do this dormitory kind of pseudo documentary, kind of introducing new airmen to the base and stuff like that. And I really had fun editing that, you know, and that was kind of where that really started going, you know. And then in 2014, I took leave from the military and was like, I'm going to go do my first film. And I flew to Germany with my ex-wife, who was my fiance at the time. And we kind of like, you know, we went and shot this film and stuff, like no script at all, like just improvised.
Oh my goodness.
Right, like, and I was so convinced that, like, you know, this is, I'm just gonna go and shoot this thing, because the idea was so clear in my mind, and I'm just gonna go make it happen. But then while we were shooting, you realize, you know, you've only been able to cover like 10 minutes. All this cool stuff you came up with, that's only like 10 minutes of a movie. So now you've wasted everybody's time, and you know, it's just kind of like, this is not happening. And in fact, but when it got done, there was, I haven't seen that movie actually since. It's just, I don't know where it is. I didn't see any of the footage after that.
Oh, wow.
And that was that, you know, and I just kind of gave up on it. I was like, you know, I'm done. I don't think I'm going to do movies anymore. And I kind of focused on the military. And then in 2015, when I got out, again, I kind of had a little depressive spell and stuff like that. I was going through a divorce, all these kinds of things. And it just kind of came back again. You know, like I started kind of writing again, first again, short stories and stuff. And I was like, hey, why don't I make a short, like an actual short? And this is like by 2016. I was like, okay, so I made this short called This Line of Work. And that basically ended up going to some festivals, doing well. It was really weird. Like we shot it on a Saturday in the weekend, me and one of my friends. And it just kind of took a life of its own, kind of, you know, and just did its own thing. And that kind of made me want to do more. Like, okay, you know what? That's actually, I felt good. You know, let me get back into it. And cashed out my TSP, my thrift savings plan, and headed out to Ghana. Because I said I was going to go do my other film, my first feature film, which had its own hurdles, but we ended up making. So that's just kind of like basically how I got into making films for a living.
So where do your stories come from? What stories do you love to tell?
I think that at the core of it, I love to tell stories that deal with complicated people. Because I myself, I'm a complicated person, so I draw from that. I'm able to draw from that kind of, because when you come from a background of several different cultures and stuff, not only there's a good side to it, and there's also a kind of a small, what's it called? I wouldn't call it a negative, but it's just kind of a thing about it too, where because there's so few people who travel and all that kind of stuff, you kind of become weird. Like you're hard for people to understand. In a way, because you're kind of an amalgamation of so many different things. So to everybody, there'll always be something different about you wherever you go, which is something that I do have, you know, like even when I went back to Ghana recently, considering someone who was raised there and all that, I was still mostly like a foreigner to them because now I speak like this. I don't have the Ghanaian accent anymore. So basically there's no belonging really, you know, you kind of, but that the positive is it makes you get to choose your home. You get to choose where you want to call home. But the other flip side of it is, you know, sometimes you're not accepted in certain places that you feel like you should be accepted.
I understand that.
Yeah.
And your feature film that you shot in Ghana, was that with like the... like in Ghana, or was that like a U.S. film you went there to shoot? Like the basis of production for the film?
Oh, yeah, everything was in Ghana, like everything completely from the ground up.
Wow. Okay.
Because we had a producer before. What gave me confidence to fly out there in the first place was that there was a producer that was willing to basically bankroll us throughout the thing. But when I got over there, it was in there, you know, that was the election year for us too over here. So when I got over there, it was their election year too. And they were kind of going through that and all that. And I suppose his funds had something to do with whoever was in power or whatever.
I see.
This is Africa, man. So
okay. The honesty. No.
Okay. Yeah, man. So he, I guess they lost and he just kind of bounced, man.
Oh,
so
I see.
He vanished and, yeah, that kind of got me in a whole different way. Like, I almost, like, I was having a breakdown because I had basically taken everything I had in the world.
And put it into that.
Basically, and put it into this journey, and this guy had walked away.
How did you pull through that?
Man, in the beginning, I spazzed, man. I went off, like, because, you know, I'm kind of like, I usually have a... mood swings and stuff like already. So like when these things happen, it takes me to the next level. Yeah. So I was like, I was so distraught and like, kind of like, yo, I'm done with this. I'm not going to make movies anymore. I always do that. Like, you know, we're like, so, you know, but like, in the moment, I usually believe it. Honestly, like I was really done. Like, it's like, yo, like this, I just can't deal with this kind of disappointment and pain, man. Like, but then now on this side of it, I now understand what other directors usually say when they say like, you gotta work the beat, man. You gotta go through the nose. Like you gotta go through all those things, because if you don't, how are you gonna be resilient enough to be confident when you walk into a room next time?
Oh,
you
so
know,
true.
And you know, yeah. So I went. That happened, and what did help me was I had a good support system, like my friend Miko, who ended up you know, who he had a house. We ended up shooting at his house, and I was actually living at his house at this time. And one day I just got up and I said to him, I was like, yo, you know, we have one resource that we really are not using. And he was like, what is it? And I was like, your house, man. I believe I can frame this house into a feature film. Like, I believe I can frame different parts of this house and we can get a feature film out of it. And he was like, nah, man. He was like, nah, it's cool. I don't think we should do this. And I was like, all right, cool. And then like 3 days later, he came at me. He was like, yo, what you were saying, I don't know what hit him, but out of nowhere, he just came back to me excited as hell about it, you know, and as heck about it. He was like, yeah, let's, you know, let's do it. Let's do it. I want to do this. I want to, you're right. You know, and we just used his house and his neighborhood and his DSLR camera that he had. We didn't even have a mic. And
wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and cause the script was so good and all I had to do was cut out all the stuff that needed money. And, you know, so basically that script can still be shot as a completely different movie right now, if I'm being honest, because we basically just kind of broke it down to the skeleton of the script and shot it with what we had. You know, we used his car in a few shots, we went to his friend's bar, you know, it was really guerrilla style.
Yeah.
And through it all, you know, there was a bunch of like stops, you know, those times when people were just like, yo, are we even going to finish this? You know, because people are not getting paid and people are getting frustrated. You know, they're like, we're not getting paid. So, like, no one is kind of wanting to,
to complete
to put in, yeah, to deliver and stuff. It's so hard to get people together and people are just kind of like lukewarm about what's going on. But we ended up, you know, doing it and ended up cutting it together in a way that we were confident would do well in some festivals. And thankfully that's kind of what happened.
Yeah. Wow. So it was completed and it got into a festival.
Oh yeah. It got into, let me see, about 4 festivals, I think.
Wow.
The 5 actually. Yeah. 5. And it was, the Caribbean. Let me see. I have them over here. Actually, I'm going to look at them real quick.
Sure.
Caribbean Lens International Film Festival 2017, which is actually here in California. And then Festival de Cortometrajes. I don't know where that was in our podcast. That was in 2016. Geo Film Festival and Expo Cinema 2017. The Grand IndieWise Convention, 2017, it was a selection. Then it was a semi-finalist for Lake International Pan-African Film Festival.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dude, that's great. Now...
Yeah, man. But thanks.
The challenges that come with that. What?
Yeah.
So how is your transition then to L.A.? Because you're making films out in California, correct?
Yeah. Well, because I was originally stationed in Sacramento, Beale Air Force Base, that's where that is. It's close to Sacramento.
Right.
I always kind of had a route, a kind of like a kind of network around here, you know, in LA, but, not film wise, you know, like, cause it was people that I had worked with, like in the military and stuff that I knew were out here and people I had met in Germany and stuff, but not film wise. So there was really no way for me to come over here at that time. But with the festivals and stuff like that, once that went in, some networking, basically, like people start reaching out. Hey, you know, I want to let me see your next project whenever you're done with it. Or someone is like, hey, you know, what are you working on? And sometimes, and actually in the beginning, a lot of it was what I was working on a horror movie at the time. And a lot of people were not they wanted like something else. They're like, yeah, everybody's doing horror. So when you have something else, let me know. So I kind of went on and did another kind of guerrilla style movie after that. But we'll come to that eventually. But like once that was going on, then the Amazon and then distribution happened, you know, because once distribution starts happening, then you kind of get into a different place. Like people are really seeing you on a completely different platform now. And it kind of comes with a certain, I would say, strength or confidence for you to walk into a pitch meeting or something. Just say, hey, so I did this and that. My film is on this platform. And if it's a respectable platform, they kind of like, kind of start listening a little closer. Like, oh, okay, you know, if this stuff is good enough to get on that platform, then we want to pay attention. You know, and that is kind of what has led to that transition to this place.
Right, right. Now, did you have to pitch to get it on Amazon?
No. What happened was after one of the, I don't remember which festival it was, but I want to believe it was the Caribbean Lens International Film Festival, I think. The film wasn't able to screen because I wasn't able to give them the DCP in time. But there was a networking event going on that day. And I met up with some a guy over there. I can't say his name, but, okay. You know, so I met him there. And he was talking to me about what they were thinking of, like, in an email, actually, later on, like an email was like, hey, if you're thinking about getting on Amazon, you know, or Netflix, let's talk, you know. And I said, well, I was actually very interested in the Netflix thing. So, because, I mean, it's Netflix. Who doesn't want to be on Netflix?
Right.
Like, yeah. And this is actually, this Netflix thing actually happened. This is before I left for the film. So that network was there already. Like this from the script perspective. Right. So when the film was actually done, that was when he basically was asking me about it at the festival. So I want to get it right because I don't want it to get misconstrued. But yeah.
Right.
So before he was like, yo, so what happened to it? You know, what happened to the film? Da, 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 da. And I was like, yeah, I got it and all that. And then he set up a meeting for me in Germany with someone. And I flew out there in March. And things were looking good and stuff like that. But then it seemed like we had to, I needed to pay this guy. He wanted me to pay him something. It became a thing of where we needed to pay some kind of commission or whatever to get this in there. And I was like, even though the deal on the other side was nice, you know, but I was kind of not feeling that. But then the Amazon thing also came where it's just Amazon Video Direct was doing this thing where they were really opening up to indie filmmakers where they wanted to give you a direct platform. They did this for a very short time, I think last year or something, like 2 years ago, within for like the last 3 years or something, but they closed it down this year where you could submit stuff directly to them, pitch it, like, you know, like it was very open. Like they were really doing town hall style, like openness with filmmakers.
Okay.
And that's basically how I got that tip from the guy, and I got a link on where it would, like, you know, he's like, hey, go up here and get on this platform and sign up and put your film there. Let's see what's up.
The insider information.
So So I go up there and I do it, and within like 3 hours, I got like a, hey, you know, welcome to the Amazon Video Direct, da 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 da. And I was very happy, you know, and I had to, basically the platform basically opens up to you kind of like in a YouTube fashion, you know,
wow.
Where you just kind of upload your thing in there and then they give you the guidelines on how to make it match up to the standard. But it's a very, very helpful tool for, to me, actually, you know, for me, it's a great way for indie filmmakers to get, or it was a great opportunity for indie filmmakers to be able to get their stuff out there and give them a platform where they can actually continually put up content now, like once they're locked in on that, you know. So, and it goes directly to, if it qualifies, it goes directly to Prime, which becomes part of the Prime catalog. So it's like, it was, for me, that was a better deal than the other one, you know, because if this was had longevity, this would go on for as long as they can.
Yeah.
And the other one was only 5 years. So I was like, okay, I'll take that. Even though this was a slow burn, at the end of the day, it's always good to, you know, be the to have the last laugh. I believe in that. So I went with that.
Now the film that you submitted to the Caribbean Film Festival that got you in contact with the insider information, that film in itself, did you raise the money on your own to create that?
No, that was just that was the same. That's the Northern King. That's the one that we're not able to raise any money. We just kind of winked.
Oh, that was the one. Okay, that's the one you do with your friend. Oh my goodness.
That's
the
one I did with my friends. Yeah. The other one, that's what I said. The other one, we'll get to that. That was on the flip side of all of this.
Okay, so I guess that's probably where we're headed next then.
Yeah, yeah. So once that got going, I got confidence to start my next one, which is Slumber Party, which was it is a horror film. Right now, actually, it's being looked at by a Hollywood studio that I can't say who it is, but they're looking at it to see if we could get the supervision from them. So we're kind of fingers crossed, excited, hoping that that happens. But that story also, we just kind of got into it, and Miko, again, a friend of that friend of mine that I was telling you about, the one that I was living with, he facilitates a lot, and he knows a lot of people, you know, so he basically hit up one of his friends who had owned a radio station, and the guy had a bunch of high-end camera equipment, you know?
Right.
And I went to Germany and talked to did a few investor talks and stuff, and was able to get a little bit from a friend of ours over there called Gunnar. He was able to also, like, invest in it. He invested a little bit in it. So between that and a friend, we basically went in, and also the little bit that came from the theatrical release of The Northern King. We were able to release it in theaters in Ghana, actually, that film that I did with my friend.
Right.
So from a little bit of that, we kind of went into Slumber Party, and it did have, like, better production values and stuff like that. And I ended up really, it was a very interesting shoot, because it's not a fun memory, because during that time I ended up losing my daughter. So it just kind of killed because it was kind of like a party film and stuff like that. And when you're directing a film and you go through such a loss, there's a certain energy you have to bring to certain types of films, you know? And when that is gone, you know, it's just kind of like, but we ended up finishing it, you know, and basically it's doing what we're trying to market it, right? We're kind of shopping it right now for distribution.
So,
Now,
curious about your, like, pitch meetings and shopping film content. What have you learned maybe about yourself as you go into these meetings, or have you learned about, like, human nature and interaction?
Yeah, so what I've learned from that whole experience is about myself, basically. I was too hard on myself initially when I first got into kind of film. And when I first started thinking about what that whole process is like, you know. And so my first few pitches, I was very tense, and, you know, it's kind of like rushing through it, because I just felt the pressure and stuff like that. And this executive I pitched to, Adam Horner, he said, hey man, you know, relax, you know, it's fine. And then he let you understand that, you know, they're just people too on the other side, and they really just want to hear this idea that you have.
Right.
And if it's cool, they're probably going to help you out with it. So this is a really cool thing. So you shouldn't be stressed. You know, like,
right.
This is a good thing. So don't be stressed about it. Just, you know, be excited. Bring that excitement out. That is what they want to see. They want to see the passion. They want to see that you don't see that you know what you're talking about. You know, they want to see that you know every little inch of that world that you've built, that you want to convince them to help you bring to life, you know.
Right.
And through that, it's been really a learning experience, and I've learned from each and everyone. Each pitch that I've done, I've learned something from it. Even the ones that, especially the ones that I don't get, because sometimes just listening to the reason why you don't get it, you realize it's just something really small. It's really nothing that can't be fixed. And that gives you a lot of confidence that you're like, okay, I could get that done, and then pitch it again to another person with that in mind. And then if you do that, sometimes you realize you start getting positive just based on the feedback that you get from the ones that you were not able to score, you know. And sometimes you actually create relationships with people who pass on your work, because they might pass on your work, but not on you. You see, because you forget as someone who makes this stuff that when they listen to an idea that you have and they feel like, okay, maybe not that one, they're like, but this guy might have some other stuff that I might like because of the way that, just from the way the person is talking, you feel like, yo, he might have something that I like. The way his mind works, he might have something else. So you kind of keep in contact with them and stuff. But that's kind of how this movie, this distribution thing I'm talking about came about. I did a pitch for someone and he loves the concept and everything, but he said it's kind of a little bit on the lower end for him. So he couldn't, because he kind of like, can you believe that? Like, that's actually a thing. Like, it was too cheap for him to make.
Oh.
You know, it was a great idea, but yeah, it was just too cheap. Like, it needed, like, it's not a big enough movie, you know? So I was like, okay. So I ended up talking to him later on. We ended up linking up, like, about a week later on LinkedIn. And he came into my suggestions and stuff because, you know, once you email people, yeah, kind of this whole algorithm thing, you know, so I, I added him and he accepted. So that was a good sign. Like, oh, okay. Cause you know, mostly that would be because when you added the person, sometimes the executives don't want to, cause they know they passed on your work. So it could be that they don't want to be harassed because that actually happens. Sometimes they can get harassed by, you know, that's a darker side to some filmmakers and stuff. Like, you know, hey, I want you to look at my work. Like, why did you say no? You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, jeez.
So I really was hoping, you know, yeah, like trying to be like, hey, okay, so I'm going to fix it for, you know, so I was really hoping he wouldn't feel like that was what was going on, you know.
Right.
And he didn't, you know, he just kind of accepted. And then I emailed him and said, hey, I took a look at your feedback and I'm very happy about this and that. And he gave me a lot of information and, you know, talk to me about some other stuff. And then that whole conversation ended up leading to, hey, you know, yeah, send me the film. I'm going to take a look at it, you know, and he's a distributor, you know, and if he likes it, he'll do what he'll make sure it gets seen because that's what he's in. He's in it to sell things that can be sold.
Of course.
You know, so,
yeah.
So, you know, so basically, yeah. So, and that came from a past, you know, on a pitch, you know, so it's a very interesting world that I'm learning that it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you pitched a script or has it always been like finished products or like video?
No, I have. What I'm working on right now, I pitched as a script. What I'm casting right now.
Okay.
That was something that came from a pitch meeting.
So you go in, and I'm kind of curious for the listeners, if you can kind of walk us through maybe, you know, without, I don't want to make you like have to go out into dire length on this, but what's the walkthrough with pitching a script?
First of all, it's all about, you first have to be able to get on whoever you're trying to pitch to, like that executive schedule.
Right.
You know, and, you know, it's you got to go through agents and different kind of, you know, you have to go through different channels and stuff, but eventually if you're able to get on the schedule, usually there's a lot of emailing involved,
right,
where, you know, you get an email and you have to wait, like it's crazy how many wait times. So what I did, in the first half of the year was to just reach out all year. I just reaching out on email and stuff. And this half now I have a whole bunch of meetings. I ended up getting a whole bunch of meetings from June. The whole month of June up to now, it was like a whole bunch of stacked up because all of them had, you know, like from the first hour, that's how long ago I had put in to try and get these meetings. And some of them were over Skype, actually. Not a lot of them were actually in person. A lot of them were kind of like this, like on the phone,
wow,
on Skype, which is usually the best. Yeah, because they're very busy people and they, you know, maybe every now and then someone might be able to have coffee, but that's usually like if they're already around where you are.
Yeah,
you know,
it's rare.
Like, it's really rare. Like, if, you know, let's say you're supposed to have a meeting at 3 o'clock and it's like 2:30, then he hits like, and they hit you up like, hey, where are you actually? And you're like, yeah, I'm in Santa Monica. He's like, okay, I'm actually in Santa Monica right now. Do you want to meet up? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's the only time this kind of happens, but normally not. Nah, it's just straight up to the phone or Skype. And then after that, a lot of emailing. And then if the emailing leads to something, then you get to have a meeting. So that's kind of how it goes. You get on the schedule, and then when the day comes, you get connected with the person. And usually it's through a third party because they never want to, like, you know, it's a safety thing for both parties. You know, no one wants to, they never give you their direct email and you never, they never get your direct email and you never get theirs. Like, it's always through a third party. So far, right now, where I am in my career, that's where it is. There's right. some levels where it's a direct thing where they just kind of walk into the studio and talk to people.
Yeah.
But, you know, like Spielberg and stuff like that. But for me right now, yeah, it's usually like through third parties. So, yeah, they at first, what you send in kind of your, what they call your log line and your synopsis, like kind of like your, it's kind of a snapshot of what the project's about.
I see. Like with and a budget so when quote they see that, as well?
Not yet. The okay. first one, because it's not solicited. That's information that they have to ask for.
Okay.
Like that, if you send it without someone asking for it, it's unsolicited. Like, you know, so sometimes they don't even open it just because of some legal. And I've been learning that now. Like, you know, it's not like people are mean that they don't want to listen to people. It's just they can't legally tie themselves to, because if the second they open that thing, even if they don't respond to you, 20 years from now, a year from now, if they make a movie or whatever that kind of seems similar to yours, you sue them and then you're able to prove they opened that email.
Oh, you know, see.
You see, so they don't, yeah. So if they did not ask for it, normally they don't even open it. They just kind of take, either let it go to spam or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when when you send this stuff, just make sure it's always start off with just like just a little synopsis. That's it. It's not like a, you know, but that one, that usually, I think that what people have just asked for is a title, to be honest.
Oh,
that's
really?
That's what I've had to input. Yeah, it's just a title and the person. Then they just kind of listen to what you have, you know, kind of spontaneously. Okay, what does he have? You know? But what that does is, because of the amount of time in between your appointments, you have to know that, like, they probably kind of look into you a little bit before they talk to you.
Of course.
You know, they'll probably look, you know, online or whatever, you know, they'll kind of check you out a little bit before they get into a meeting with you. And then on the meeting day, you go in and it's very straightforward. It's not really, because there's always a finite amount of time you have.
Yeah.
That's another thing. They can tell you, say, hey, I only have 3 minutes, or I only have 8 minutes, or I only have 10 minutes, depending on what it is that they want to accomplish in that meeting. You know, so when they sit down, they just introduce themselves. It's not like they're being, you know, like they're rude or something, but like they got to get to it. Because you got to understand that you are not the only person they're listening to that day. They're
right.
listening to a whole lot of different people. That's their job. Their job is to do this and find projects to buy.
Yeah.
You know, so
literally.
That's the thing. So I think that sometimes you walk in thinking that maybe you're coming in with like, something that you've never heard before, something like, you got to get all that out of your mind, you know? even if it's a very unique idea, it's good. Like, let them tell you that.
Right, right.
You know, or be able to, you should be able to, how do you call it? You should be able to show them how that is unique. If you're going to say it is, you should be able to prove it and demonstrate why. If you're gonna actually add that to your pitch, then you should also have the reason in the pitch. You
I
know,
see.
Like, hey, if you're gonna say, okay, I think I have a very unique idea that no one has seen before. Well, you gotta let them know why. Why do you think that?
Right.
Why do you
right.
feel like there's an idea no one has seen before? You know, and then you get them into it and stuff like that. And it's not also a thing where a lot of people think, and I used to think that you have to tell the people like them the entire movie.
Not the case.
Like A to Z, you know. No, you're gonna lose people fast. Because I mean, think about it. Like, if you're actually gonna narrate a movie, you're gonna lose them because they're boring parts in the movie. You know.
Yeah. Okay.
So basically, what they want is just get straight to it. Like, okay, let me use what I'm about to shoot, Slumber Party, as an example. If you're gonna pitch Slumber Party. Or you just have to, what they want to know is a group of college kids decide to host a party for their graduation. So they have to host a graduation party. A mysterious killer starts taking them out one by one. So now he's going to ask you, okay, why? You see, that's kind of how you could go about it. Like, why did the person start doing that?
Right.
You know, what's the motivation? How did this all happen? Then you say, well, this and that. You know, this, because you have to know basically the whole picture is for them to know that you actually know the story you're telling.
Yeah.
Every plot hole, everything that they can throw at you, you know, you have an answer for it. Like, you've thought about it in advance. And also, of course, you got to think on your feet. If it's something you haven't thought about, you better come up with something.
Quickly.
You better come up with something quick.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, it's a pretty fun thing. And then after that, they'll tell you, you hear from them in about a month. And it's true. Like, they stay true to that. Like, it takes about a month for you to hear anything back. And it's either, you know, and when they do take time to let you know why they want to see more or why they're passing on it, you know. And when they say they want to see more, they basically ask you for your script. And then you send that in, and that can take months for them to, like, get back to you. Actually, there's actually one, the movie I'm casting for right now, there's an executive that is actually still thinking about it, about whether or not he wants to help make it as of now. So, that's just kind of how it keeps going. So, like, sometimes you can hear someone is attached to something, and then in about 2 weeks, you're like, actually, this other person is the one doing it. Because, like, in a month, if he comes up and he's like, hey, I think we are ready to go. I think I can let you guys, I can executive produce this, and we can shoot it in the time that you want to shoot. Suddenly, that's who is executive producing the movie. You know?
Yeah.
But at all times, you, the artist, you, the filmmaker, you got to keep doing your part also. You just got to keep working on it. Don't ever, like, there's never, once you pitch it, you don't chill and relax and say, all right, I'm waiting. Nah. Well, even though I'm pitching, I'm also doing pre-production. Because the more you have done, the more it looks like you actually want to do this. And you've actually put a lot into it already. You know, you have to, there has to be that trail of, you know, work. And to show that you're working, this person is actually actively working on this. And also, sometimes it should have the feel of, with or without you, I'm going to end up doing this thing anyway.
Yeah.
You know, they should have that in there. Like, they should feel like that about you. That, hey, man, like, this guy is really going to do this thing no matter what. So maybe it'll be good for him. He would really love if you would help him, but he's still going to power on ahead anyway, you know.
I see. So it's like, with or without you, I'm making it. Would you like to be a part of it?
Basically.
So have you, it's just curious, do you have any recommended books or resources on, like, pitching, pre-production, creating a budget, film in general?
Yeah. Well, one, and that's a book that I kind of accidentally, someone left it in the plane a few years back. Yeah. It's called Film After Film. And it's written by a person called Jay Haberman. I never went in to see whether it was a man or a woman, so I don't know if it's a guy or girl. But yeah, like, he's basically worked on, you know, a lot of different movies. And I only read, like, the first about 20 pages because of my very short flight. And I didn't want to take it with me, so I left it there. But it stuck with me since.
Wow.
You know, go film after film. And just the small insight I started seeing, you know, in just reading it, talking about kind of like the post 9/11 age, basically the post digital age, basically, you know, like, of filmmaking and kind of where, and kind of some predictions that it was making about where film is going. And this is in 2013, I think I read it. So a lot of the things that I was seeing in it are actually, like, that's actually where things are right now, basically. The way that it was looking at where digital was going to go, streaming, all these kinds of things. But the art of actual filmmaking, like, it started off with that. Like, that's where I learned a lot about a lot of different things.
Wow.
In just, like, 20 pages. Like, it's a really good book. It's called Film After Film.
Yeah, I wrote that down, definitely. Do you have any favorite films, like, or screenplays or documentaries that you really enjoy, think were done well?
Yeah, man. Like, I'm one of those, like, you know, I have a lot of, I usually, somehow I kind of I end up liking a lot of works by people that maybe a lot of people have, people who kind of have detractors, not like on purpose. It's just for some reason I like that stuff. Like one of my favorite directors is Zack Snyder, for example.
Okay.
And his films, they, you know, like I feel like he, as a, like when you look at it as a film, like from a film perspective, like, yo, this man, he knows film. You know, and the way that he tries to, he uses very classical film techniques in otherwise kind of a weird, kind of an unrealistic world that he, some of his movies are taking place, like, you know, like Man of Steel, you know, Batman v Superman, which I know a lot of people have a lot to say about.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, but, you know, like for me looking at it, I was like, this is a classic. He is, it is classical things happening, but like, maybe people don't want to see that in that genre, you know? And I was like, if he applied this to just, if he just, that BVS story, if it was a story, that same thing that just took place between, think about it. If it was just something that took place between a, like an African-American moving into an all white neighborhood and the other, you know, one of the cops in the neighborhood doesn't like him and I'm taking him down because I don't trust him. Yeah. Kind of like where Batman was coming from. It's like, you realize, oh, well, we are going to some really interesting places right now. Or even if it's like, someone of Hispanic descent going into a neighborhood where they don't, people are like, hey, we don't want to see you, you know? And yet this person is probably like a good person, you know, trying to do good, helping people out, saving people, all these kinds of stuff, but they're still like, yeah, man, like, we don't want you here. Like, you're weird.
Yeah, you're different.
You know, these kinds of things.
We don't want
you. Yeah, you're different, you know? And for me, I think he touches on, I guess maybe it's because I'm an immigrant. I understand where these, you know, the way he portrays these kind of, like, characters and stuff. Like, I kind of relate to these characters. But another film I really love is The Dark Knight, which I think that one everyone agrees on.
Yeah.
By Christopher Nolan. Like, that's another really well-made film that every time I think about filmmaking, that's another one I go to. And then there's Fight Club.
Yeah.
By David Fincher. Really good one. And then there's a really unknown, less unknown Robin Williams film called What Dreams May Come. I don't know if people saw that, but it seemed like it was very low-key and stuff, but I really love it. It's a very surreal kind of meta kind of storytelling about life and death.
Yeah.
Really, really, really beautiful movie.
The Dark Knight. What did you love about it? What, in your opinion, made it such a great film?
Basically, it's the way that he took a character. Like, well, I've been reading comics since I was a kid, and well, not since I was a kid, but since my this was like in my teens.
Okay.
And for me, Batman has always been that, like, basically what Chris Nolan attempted to do was, or did very successfully, was to show that this can actually happen, in a character like Batman can happen in real life, and a character like the Joker that they had in there can also happen, because
yeah,
they seem so like, these people, like, Joker just seemed like a crazy dude, like, you would see on the street. It's just, he's all dressed up and, you know, and he's clean, but, like, he's so crazy. You know,
right.
So it's like if one of those guys, like, had goons and stuff, and he's just allowed to do whatever he wants. Like, you know, he puts people's faces in pens and stuff. Like, he just does a lot of off-the-cuff stuff, and, you know, just know this guy is really, really nuts. Like, you can't reason with this person. You know, and then you have Batman, who is order. You know, he wants order, and he wants to bring justice and everything into Gotham, trying to clean up Gotham City. And so you juxtapose those two, and you realize, like what he said, you know, they're going to keep doing this forever. You know, because of where it goes. And that is, I think, that's the lesson of it. That, for me, that was the thing of it, that, and why Batman ended up running away at the end of the movie, is that he's realizing, I have to shift the focus on me, because this guy is he's going to be in jail, but it's only a matter of time before he comes back out. But
yeah,
if you're able to use this opportunity to make a certain law, you know, you know, that could actually prevent people like that from escaping and just kind of like locking them, clean up the street. That would work. And it did work, of course, but until 8 years later when Bane showed up. But, but you know, it ended up working because, yeah, like that was the only way they could do it. They had to lie. Like, he actually had to corrupt the very thing he was trying to, he's always fighting for. He had to corrupt the very fabric of that justice system that he's always fighting to uphold, you know, with this big lie to end up, to basically get what he wanted. But that showed him that that doesn't last. Someone always has to be fighting. And that, I think that's the lesson we learn in The Dark Knight Rises later on. It's just like, whatever you do, someone has to keep fighting. Because however you go, yeah, it just has to keep happening.
Yeah, it does. It does. It absolutely does. And do you live by or have any like texts you refer to daily or quotes that you live by or like phrases or mantras?
Yeah, I actually just recently developed my new mantra, which is, you know, we'll see how it goes, or we'll see. Because we'll see. I had like there's a history of that. About a year and a half ago, like I was in a completely different space, you know, while just trying to talk to Amazon, try to, you know, get things together for my second film and all these kinds of things. And I had the habit of getting excited about things just off of the possibility of it happening.
Yeah.
You know, like someone would say, hey, you know, let me see your script or something. And I get excited. Like, oh, I'm very excited. This is going to da da da, you know. And then it would not prepare you for the no or the, okay, I'm not even going to respond to this person. You know, none of that. Like, you don't, so you take it, you internalize it, and you're thinking all these kinds of things. And that is because you spent so much time creating a future that you and no one told you was going to happen.
Right.
You know, and you got infatuated with it, and now you realize it's not going to happen, but like, your mind has become used to that idea of it happening, that now it's almost as if you're actually losing something. But if you really think about it, you didn't lose anything. You know, like, that's why I had to think about it for myself. Like, I had to tell myself that, hey, man, you didn't lose anything. At the end of the day, like, look at things that are in front of you. Take things step at a time. And I had to go through a lot, you know, with my daughter and stuff like that. But on the other side of it, I just came out realizing patience is basically virtue, really. You know, patience truly is virtue, because I just had to take things as they came. Like, you know, if someone, like with these pitches and stuff like that, I'll do a pitch and not really expect anything to come out of it, you know? I'm like, yeah, it'll be nice if things come out. I do have kind of an idea what or where I want to go with it if something good comes out of it. But I'm also looking to the next pitch with excitement now.
Yeah.
You know, I have that to be excited about. I don't allow expectations to tie me down. Basically, I live within the now. Basically, I live in the moment. That's basically my what I do now. That's my mantra.
Now, that's a good one, to live in the moment. Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you're bringing up a good point about how excited we can get when we hear something. It's like, oh, maybe I'll take a look at that. And it's like as good as a yes. And it's like, it's nothing yet.
Right. It's nothing at all. Like, sometimes it's not even true. Sometimes they're just saying that to get rid of you.
Yeah.
You know, and you get all excited about it.
Well, geez, thank you for talking about all of this with me. This is like such a plethora of knowledge in terms of film and life.
Oh, I'm
so
very I'm really happy I was able to come on, man. Like, this, I should come back on. Just, I liked our interaction.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a feeling we could probably do a part 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in terms of film.
Yeah,
just
I'm down
alone.
For that. I'm down for part 2, yeah. I'm definitely down for that.
Well, where can we find you?
I'm mostly active on Instagram and Twitter at MG EMJEED. That's usually where anyone can find me. And when you find me on there, you'll be able to see all my other stuff. I'm also on IMDb under M. Saibu if you want to check out some of my other works and what's coming. It is just M. Saibu, like with the, I think it's going to be in the title of the show, right?
Yeah.
So, if you just search that name, Google, if you Google it, almost everything I've done usually pops up when you Google it.
Yeah, it's all there on IMDb. I'll have links to all of this in the show notes.
Awesome.
Well, M. Saibu, thank you
for sitting down with me and chatting. I really appreciate taking the time talking over the phone here.
Oh, man, I appreciate you, man. Thanks for reaching out. And, yeah, let's definitely do this again.
100%. Ladies and gentlemen, M. Saibu.
You've been listening to Entertainment X, the podcast. You can follow Entertainment X on Instagram at @EntertainmentX_. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join Clay next week for another Curiosity Conversation on Entertainment X. Thank you for listening.